Mr. Hutton, Reel 13. We're talking about the time you're in Cosenza with Joe Bonici. What sort of things were you doing with Joe, and why was his work... What was so good about him?
Well, that is, I really can't tell you, but we knew that practically everything we went after, right, way back from when we were in North Africa, he was the brains behind our... It wasn't the officer. He was useless. Anything that we went on, it was following up something that Joe Bonici was on to.
Well, how did he found it out? Do you see what I mean? Where Joe Bonici got his information?
I don't know. I don't know. Joe didn't used to tell me. I was quite pally with him, but you know, in that war, you weren't told everything unless you were a... I think this war, I think people are told more. But if you were down below two stripes or three stripes, you were nothing really.
But he was only a sergeant.
He was only a sergeant, but he shouldn't have been. He should have had a commission, really. He was doing all the work for...
And what did he do when you were with him? I mean, the bits you did see him doing, what was he doing when you went out with him?
Well, he'd send me to go and fetch certain people, and he'd take them in, and I wouldn't be there. But anyway, I wouldn't have been able to understand what they were talking about.
So you just went and fetched someone, and he interviewed him at the headquarters?
I'd fetch them in, and sometimes we'd both go and fetch them. But they've got to remember, they were jabbering away in Italian. I mean, I could make myself understood in Italian. I could get myself some food or drink or get my laundry washed and things like that. But I couldn't tell you what was going on.
What was he like as a person?
Well, he was like me. He liked good food and drink and things like that. And
I thought you said he liked the ladies as well.
He liked the ladies as well. Yeah, and the ladies liked him. Oh yes, the ladies liked Joe.
But, How old was he?
He was older than me. I think he was 7 or 8 years older than me. I would be about 22 or 3. He was about 30, I think. Well, he was definitely older than me.
And how long were you at Cosenza about?
I think we were there for about 3 weeks. I'm not sure. You know, it's a hell of a long time to...
What's the next thing you remember then? Because I know you get a bit vague about...
I can remember coming out of Cosenza... If we'd waited another day or two, we'd never have got out, because there's been a lot of rains. You know how these Italian rivers flood. The bridge into Cosenza was blown up, being destroyed, and we'd gone over a ford into the town. We'd driven our motorbikes through the ford, and then we got the rains and the what rain came off the mountain, the rivers rose ever so quickly. And when we drove out of Cosenza, it sounded like a motorbike. You know, our exhaust was very nearly under the water, going plop, 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 just sounded like a motorbike. As another hour or two, we've had to have had some other way of getting our motorbikes out. But I can remember that plopping away as we drove the motorbikes out.
And where did you go then?
To tell you that, I should imagine we went to Foggia. Foggia. And that is when I got heard of a chance that there was people who'd been out 3 or 4 years could get home to England, you see. And they were talking about getting ready for D-Day and things like that.
About when was this, roughly, in the year?
It'd be about November time, I think. November time. That's October, November, October time. The winter was just setting in. And I'd heard this rumour about... there was a chap... People were going home to England, who'd been out a long time. Well, I found a chap at 8th Army Headquarters, who was working in the right department. I gave him a Beretta automatic and a portable typewriter, and he got me onto this going home to England lark.
And you'd presumably found these in the course of...
When I wasn't finding food, I was finding a few other things that were useful to have.
So much looting going on amongst the...
Well, a lot of people, to feel security, were in a good position. But I, really, all I bothered about was food. But I thought that this portable typewriter was useful for me to write my reports on. You know, used to go like this with two fingers.
You got permission. You got the...
So, somehow I got this bit of paper that said to proceed to UK by the quickest possible means. I mean, what more could you have than that? So I set off quite glad. You know, I was about fed up with it all because the weather was nasty. They talked about Sicily was ever so sunny and nice. But as soon as we got to Italy, the weather got worse. So I set off, and I got myself down to right back to the toe of Italy again. And I got on a landing barge that took me across to Sicily. And then I got on an American landing barge that took me across from Sicily to Tunis. Now, this was a flat-bottom landing barge. And they talk about the Mediterranean being like a mill pool. And I'm a bad sailor. And this flat-bottom boat was going up, coming down, crash like this on the water. Oh, by Jove, I was seasick. I felt terrible. But the crew they were terrified. They thought these landing barges were riveted things. And they thought the rivets were going to bust. I wasn't frightened. I couldn't have cared if the damn thing had turned over and sunk. I felt terrible. But the crew didn't like it at all. We eventually landed in... And remember the American Navy? They seem to have this fried sort of spam and stuff, and they sort of put sort of stuff like jam on it. Sweet, I suppose it'd be sweet pickle. I remember eating that. But anyway, we landed in Tunis, a whole lot of us, to go back to catch a boat at Algiers, and we all got into... The Royal Army Service Corps were there in lorries, and we all loaded into these lorries. Now, they were crafty chaps, these Royal Army Service Corps. We fell for what they said. They said to us, there's a boat in Algiers, a convoy, there's a boat going at Algiers, but I think you're going to miss it. We're not going to be able to do it because we've got to drive along the Atlas Mountains. It was a hell of a journey, and they told us that it was touch and go whether we should catch this boat, you see. Now, I think they used to tell this story to everybody, so everybody had a whip round to give the drivers money to put the foot down. Well, I think they used to tell this tale to everybody, so we all put our money in and gave the drivers this money. I've told you wrong. I said that there wasn't only me. There was another chap with me. This sergeant, you know, the one on that flat roof job I told you about. He was with me as well. And we all got into the lorry, you know, in the back of the lorry. And you can't see. And you can only see out of the back because there's a big sheet over the thing. But he drove with the driver in the front. And he says he'd never been so terrified in his life on these mountain roads and mountain... drivers were going like hell. And he said it was most frightening. But we were in the back and looking out from the back. It didn't seem so bad, but we were being bumped and banged about. But he said it was terrifying because there were great big drops and hairpin bends. And he said it really was frightening. And it took us about 3 days of this, driving like hell on these Atlas Mountains to Algiers. Well, we got to Algiers and we were taken to a transit camp about 6 miles outside Algiers. And, of course, when we got there, there was no boat. And we were told we might be waiting a week or two before there was a boat. And so I think these chaps had just did. We hadn't got much money. We had the whip round and given all these Royal Army Service Corps drivers that had the money, what little bit we'd got. And we went, one Saturday afternoon, we managed to get into Algiers somehow. But when we got there, we'd got no money. I just saw Algiers for one. And then I think we walked back, and it was quite a few mile or two, 6 miles. It was on the race course outside Algiers we were camped. And we were there for a long time, a week or two, waiting for this boat. And one day it said the boat was ready, there was a convoy, and we had all the kit, and we had to march all the way to the docks at Algiers with our kit. Well, I wasn't going to do this. I'm not going to carry that stuff all that way. So I got rid of everything except my small kit, you know, my shaving tackle and things. I'd dumped everything. And we marched all the way to the docks at Algiers. Now, when we got there, there was a lot more to get on the boats than us. We were all divided up, but there was the glider pilot regiment, a lot of the Highland Division, all with units, and then there was a lot of odds and sods left, like us. There was a major, and a lieutenant, a sergeant major, a sergeant, me, and about 30 or 40 pioneers. They'd come out to North Africa to do something with the North Island. They were dockers, the army dockers, called pioneers. Well, this major was in charge of the odds and sods. And we got on the boat, and we were on a very fine boat, the Monarch of Bermuda. And there I was with Lance Corporal. Well, the major, he wasn't interested. He put us on to the lieutenant. The lieutenant put us on to the sergeant major. The sergeant major put us on to this sergeant, pal of mine, who'd come with me. He was in charge then. And he put it on to me. So I was in the bowels of the ship. Quite a nice accommodation, nice cabin, but right down in the bottom of the ship. With these 30 pioneers. And the most bolshy crowd of men you couldn't imagine. And I was in charge of them. And so we the food was to start with. You had to, there's another dishing food job out, you see. And it was sat at these long tables, and the food was quite good on this boat. But you've got a great big dish of food, and I'd got to sort it out, you know, serve it, the meat and stew. And there was this great long table with them all at it. And it's not easy to sort it out so that everybody's got a fair share. It's there again. You either finished up with none if you were serving it. There was none left for me because I'd served, I'd given them too much. But there's a bloke grumbling, so I thought, well, I know how to deal with him. I grumbled once and the sergeant major dealt with me. The one who's doing the most grumbling, the real barrack room, I said, right, you can serve the food out. So he served the food out. And the others on the table made sure they got their fair share. And I found all the troublemakers. I knew how to deal with them. I'd got to have someone to clean the loos out, because there's a ship's inspection every day on the troop ship, you know. So another big troublemaker. But I gave him excused all duties. All he'd got to do was to clean the loos out. Well, he was quite happy to do that and make a good job if he didn't have to do anything else. And I dished out all the jobs amongst the troublemakers. So I'd got that all sussed out nicely. And most of them spent all the time on this boat playing cards, brag. All day long they played brag. And I was down in the bowels of the ship with them. But I'd got some books to read. I was quite enjoying myself. It was a damn sight better trip than when we came out at the beginning of the war, because the food was good. But it was trying to look after this Bolshy crowd with one stripe, and it wasn't easy. Because nobody, there was nobody, and there was ship's inspections all the time. And one day, it was a big convoy we were in, and we used to go up on deck and you could see the convoy. And we moved out the Mediterranean and into the Atlantic, and they said we were going, it was the time when the Germans' submarines were hunting in packs or something, on the surface or something, or so they said anyway. Didn't quite understand what that was about. And we were going to have to... there was a lot of talk about submarines, you see. And we were right down in the bowels of the ship one night, and I was reading my book and all these chaps were playing brag, the most undisciplined lot they were. And all of a sudden there was a hell of a sort of thud and a bang and all the lights went out. And I thought, Christ, we've been torpedoed. And I think all the other chaps thought they'd been torpedoed. And then the lights came on again. And they know that these waterproof doors like this, sort of only one man can go through at a time. If you tried to see three or four men trying to get through a watertight door, they really panicked. I shouted and told them to, you know, not to panic and things like that, but they didn't take any notice of me. Some of them really got quite hurt trying to get through these, you know, sort of, damn you, Jack, I'm all right, trying to get through the... nothing like women and children first, you know, it's nothing like that. But it was a bit alarming. You're right down in the bowels of the ship and you think you've been torpedoed. But it wasn't that at all. There was a ship called the Duchess of Devonshire. I'm sure that's what her name was, the Duchess of Devonshire. And she'd got icebreaker bows. And her steering gear went. And she holed us just on the waterline. You see, made a big hole in us. Well, we were near to jib, because we'd just passed through out into the Atlantic. Well, the convoy carried on, and we turned back and went to jib. And we were in Gibraltar Harbour for about 3 weeks whilst they mended it. We weren't allowed ashore. We were on that boat. I don't know whether there was 3,000 men on that boat or not, but we were there. And we were never allowed ashore. I think the officers, some of the officers went ashore, but we weren't. Now, we're all hoping to be home for Christmas, you see. But we stayed there longer and longer and longer, and we thought never were going to be home for Christmas. That's all we wanted, was to be home for Christmas. But eventually we were repaired, and we set sail. Now, the Monarch of Bermuda was a pretty modern liner, and it could go fairly fast. So we were going to go without escort, no destroyer escort. We were going to go right out into the Atlantic, you know, and then come right back via Scotland somehow. And it was a long journey, but we eventually arrived at Liverpool, and there was a band there to meet us. And now you've never seen such a bullshy lot of soldiers who were on this boat. I mean, it was rather a fine sight to arrive back in England and a band there to meet you. But they booed the band. Not at all. And you know how the army makes you hang about? All we wanted to do was get home for Christmas. And a lot of the brass hats and high-ranking officers, they were getting off the boat and going, and we stayed behind. And every time anybody went, people booed them. And so anyway, this other chap with me, this sergeant in field security, we thought, well, we're never going to get home for Christmas. And we'd got field security. See, we're in field security, and we got field security, and there's lots of red. We got the field security armband on, and it was like magic, that green field security. It was like magic, that was. So we put our armbands on, what bit of kit we'd got left, for our kit, and we went down the gangway. and marched off. She, nobody stopped her. She, no, when you were wearing that thing, nobody stopped you.
It was green.
It was a green and grey band with FSP written on it. And even the sort of red caps used to treat us with awe, you know. And they thought we'd got a much better job than we really had. Just the same with the Italians. We'd tell them that we were the security police, and they thought we were like the Gestapo, you see. Italians did. And we went down the gangway and marched on. And if you've never ever been booed by 3,000 men, we were booed. It's so funny. And we marched past all the red caps and everything and went on to the station and got on a train to Sheffield, because that's where our base depot was at
the
Wentworth.
The Field Security Police.
At Wentworth, you see. Near, there's a golf course. Is that where the Wentworth go? Anyway, it's near Sheffield, Rotherham, this base depot. It's a big country house. And I got on the train and we'd got our 8th Army medals, and they were a bit quite rare things in England then. We got our 8th Army medal band on, and the civilians wanted to know, where we'd come from on the train and that sort of thing. And I asked one to ring my... He'd got off the train somewhere, and I asked him to ring my parents up to tell them I'd arrived in England, because they didn't know I was coming home. And we went back to the thing, and we were given 28 days leave. And I arrived home on the Christmas Eve, on the Saturday on the Christmas Eve. And I had 28 days leave, and thoroughly enjoyed myself. Then I was stationed, went down to London, and we were now getting ready for the invasion. I was stationed at Highgate, near the something Heath. What is it? Near
Hampstead Heath.
Hampstead Heath. Lovely. So we had a lovely house we were in on Hampstead Heath.
Do you know what it was called?
And it was very near the Spaniards Inn. There was an inn called...
Kenwood House?
Hmm?
Kenwood House?
I don't know. It was a nice house, and it was very near the Spaniards Inn, and it wasn't all that far from the old Bull and Bush. I thoroughly enjoyed going to the Spaniards Inn, or the old Bull and Bush.
And what were you doing there? You'd been sent there?
We were sent there getting ready to go on the invasion, and we've been trained for that job.
What extra training did you get then, Hall?
Well, what happened was, we were only a small unit, and we hadn't got a doctor, so we went to a civilian doctor in Highgate, who was really, he'd also got another practice in Harley Street. He was a Harley Street specialist, and he had this sort of poor people's surgery in Highgate. And I had to go and see him about something. And he told me I should never have been in the army.
Why was that?
Because of my eyes, you see. And he said, you shouldn't be in the army. And so the next thing I know, I was... getting a transfer out of the army. And it was... had about 6 weeks or so. Which is the...
Did you have to take tests on your eyes?
No, they kept sending me to this hospital and that, it was the worst 6 weeks I've ever had in my life in the army. Been messed about, didn't know what was happening to me.
Did you want to stay here?
I came home, I was quite happy to go, I was expecting to go.
So when you got out of Italy, you just wanted to go home. You didn't want to get out of active service at all.
No, I just wanted a chance to get home and a change. And I thought, well, we'll go on the invasion. And I thought it would be different. But then, as I say, my wife was... she'd been a pen friend, and I'd come home and seen her on the... Ken Chu, he'd come home.
He was wounded, wasn't he?
He was wounded, and he had come home, and he said, come and see Jean. I nearly didn't go, but I did, and I liked what I saw. And I thought, well, the army doesn't want me. Let's get out the army.
So that influenced your decision not
That influenced my decision. And but that last 6 weeks, and I suddenly realised that soldiering in England was terrible. Oh, God, it was awful.
What did you hate? Was it the bull again?
All the bull and the people who didn't know what the hell they were talking about, telling you what to do and things like that.
Did you resent only being a lance corporal? Because you'd had a lot of experience.
No, I don't think that bothered me, but I could see it was going to be a very different life. The way the army treated people was so different to what it was abroad. It was, you see, and I feel really sorry for the chaps who spent 4 years in England waiting to go on, and a lot of them did. Most of them stayed all the time in England waiting to go on the invasion from Dunkirk till then, and I think soldiering in the army in England must have been terrible. I can remember that Jean, my wife, was working in Burnley. She was a personnel manager at a factory, at one of those shadow factories at Burnley. And I'd got in with the sergeant major at this place at Highgate, and he used to let me have my pass on a Friday night instead of a Saturday morning, you know. But then I'd got to dodge all the red caps on St Pancras Station because my pass didn't last until Saturday morning. This was Friday night. But so I used to get by them. I'd got plenty of money. I wasn't short of cash. I used to book myself a sleeper. You see, and only officers went on sleepers. You see? I used to book myself a sleeper. Once you'd got on that sleeper, as far as the red caps were concerned, you were safe. But when the St Pancras station used to be absolutely lousy with red caps. So I was walking to the train one day, I spotted where the train was, looking at, there was two red caps there, there was so I walked straight up to them and said, "Is that the train for Manchester?" "Yes, mate, there it is," because I got on it and went, but that sergeant major had been in trouble for letting me have my pass early, you see. So I used to go up to see Jean most weekends, but it was this business of dodging the red caps.
So eventually they put you out of the army?
And then they put me out of the army, but oh, it was...
Well, when did you leave then? That would be...
But it was all... Do you know what I was doing? I got myself a job peeling potatoes.
So there was no chance of staying in the field police, even if you'd wanted to?
I wasn't going to be allowed to drive. It was so different to soldiering abroad with they'd got a lot of people who were, I don't know, I could say, I don't reckon much, the sooner I get out, the better. But so that 6 weeks of getting out was the worst 6 weeks I ever had in the army.
So you got a job peeling potatoes?
Well, that didn't seem a bad number because it was quite cold, and I used to have a hundredweight of potatoes to peel, and I just sat by the boiler down in the cellar, nice and warm, peeling these potatoes, and had to do a whole bath full of potatoes, and that's all that was free for the rest of the day then. And I got plenty of money, and I used to go off to the West End. So that wasn't too bad. And then I found a better job doing the garden, because this was one of these London houses, and I kept the garden neat and tidy. And that excused me all the duties. But that 6 weeks was pretty grim. It's a good job I got plenty of money to spend.
So what did you do when you were actually out?
When I came out, I went farming.
Straight away?
Yeah.
In 1944? Yeah. Mm. How did you get started in that?
Well, I went and worked on a farm for nothing. You know, I didn't get paid. I just, I went and worked on this farm for nothing. Get a bit of experience. And then I worked on another farm, and I finished up coming here.
And bought your own farm?
I've got this farm of my own, but I was I can remember I went to a farm in Leicester near Beaver Castle, in the beaver country. I went and worked on a farm there, and the farmer started chasing me about a bit, told me to hurry up, and I can remember told him the only time I run was when Germans are chasing me. I wasn't going to run for him. And told him what he could do with his job. But, the silly sod, there was D-Day came, and all the aeroplanes and bombers and were all coming from here. And it was a lovely day. And we came in to have a lunch, I did, and we got all the news about the landing in Norway, D-Day. And this farmer came in, he came a little bit later for his lunch, and we told him D-Day had happened. He wasn't the least bit interested. He was only interested in what the carrots were coming through. He could see them. And I thought if he was much interested in the war, that I wasn't going to stay with him. So I told him what he could do with his job.
Thank you very much.
But I think...